From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The grand bargain back on the table. President Obama wines and dines with the GOP. Dinner guest, Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, spoke to CNN.
I think the president probably walked away saying that it was one of the best meetings he had been involved in probably since he's been here. And I think people on our side, the 12 senators that were there, felt like there was a lot of sincerity and straightforwardness.
Encouraging signs for the economy. Unemployment drops to the lowest rate in 4 years and the Dow breaks records. Here's Thursday's closing bell. And Venezuela's Hugo Chavez loses his battle with cancer. Venezuelan Vice President Nicolas Maduro made the announcement Tuesday and mourners took to the streets.
At 4:45 today on the 5th of March, the Commander President Hugo Chavez has died.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Susan Davis of USA Today, Gideon Rose of Foreign Affairs Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. Do you think a budget grand bargain is possible? What is Venezuela's future post-Chavez? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Susan, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Jane.
Join me also from New York City, Gideon Rose, editor for Foreign Affairs. Gideon, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here, Jane.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us as always. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Susan, and Gideon.
So top of the news this morning, in New York City, a son-in-law of Osama bin Laden is due to appear in federal court later this morning on terrorism charges. Suleiman Abu Ghaith allegedly plotted to kill Americans. He praised the 9/11 attacks and warned that there would be more. Gideon Rose, I'll start with you. What's the significance of this trial in New York?
Well, I think actually the fact that it probably will come off in New York without too much hoopla one way or the other is another signification that we've come past the more heated domestic and ideological debates over how to conduct the war on terror and can finally start to do this in the sort of relatively routine way that we probably should have been doing it all along. In other words, here's a guy who was a relatively minor figure, real but minor player in al-Qaeda, who was caught eventually when one of our allies passed him on to us after Iran released him and is now being brought to trial. He'll be tried in a New York court in a civilian process that by and large probably makes sense. He'll go to get his sentence over a long period of time and no more will be heard from him. I don't think it's a hugely significant story. And the very fact that we're treating it as relatively routine news is a sign that we can deal with these issues without the emotional hysteria and political hoopla that they were attracted over the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Susan Davis, possibly a signal, though, of more prosecutions like this one, as standard as they may be now. Ahead?
It is possible. I do think that there are still an ongoing debate, at least in Congress, about it's sort of reviving this question of whether they should be tried on domestic soil or at Guantanamo. At least two Republican senators yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who's been very out front on these issues, as well as Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire, have both said that they're going to try and fight the president's ability to try this in New York. Now, it raises a lot of questions about what tools they might have in their toolbox to be able to do that, because there does seem to be broad discretion to the executive branch to prosecute these cases. But it is unusual almost in the sense, too, and this is probably a debate we'll get into a little bit later, but it is a rare instance in which we are actually going through the court process versus capturing versus killing terrorist threats or enemy combatants. So it's sort of interesting and notable in the process sense of how we're finding these people. And there's certainly people that do not support the idea of trying them on civilian and U.S. soil, but it doesn't seem like they're going to have much ability to fight it.
All right, let's shift to politics now, to Washington. The hope for a grand bargain, big news this week. President Obama, of course, going on a charm offensive, really, hosting a dinner at an upscale Washington hotel near the White House. He had lunch with Paul Ryan. Susan Davis, what do you make of this shift in strategy, seemingly, for the White House?
Well, on the optics, it's nice, right? It's sort of, we hear this thing all the time about how people want to see their leaders compromising and they want to see them talking. And in that respect, I think that the president will probably get a bump out of it. But, you know, we'll see. This is a lot of sizzle, not a lot of steak yet, in the sense that we have gone through 2 years of this dance between Republicans and the president about long-term grand bargain type deals on the economy in terms of bringing down the deficit and reforming the tax code. And they haven't really made much progress. And they've gotten close, but they've never been able to cross the finish line. I think part of the reason why the president is motivated to do it this time is in the sequester, the budget cuts that took effect March 1st, in the buildup to those, the president sort of went out with the hammer against congressional Republicans and thought that maybe bullying them and making, making a case across the country that they had to change was going to work. And it didn't. So now this time, after the cuts are already in effect and they're still trying to find the resolution, it's an obvious different tack the president's taking, hoping that it'll have a different outcome in the end.
Right. Direct negotiations with lawmakers. Gideon Rose, do you see this getting better? Do you see the two sides coming closer to a deal?
You know, Churchill famously said at one point early in the Cold War that jaw-jaw is better than war-war. He meant that with regard to the Soviet Union and nuclear conflict. Maybe it applies in D.C. as well. I don't see any particular significance in the sense we're not going to get a grand bargain anytime soon. But sure, if the politicians in Washington can stop being so childish and having giant tamper tantrums that screw up the nation's credit rating and actually start talking to each other like mature adults, that would be a big significant upgrade.
Here's some sound from Thursday. As I mentioned, President Obama invited Congressman Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, and Chris Van Hollen, Democrat from Maryland, to the White House for lunch and a frank discussion about budget challenges. Ryan is chair of the House Budget Committee. Van Hollen is the ranking Democrat on that committee. Van Hollen spoke to CNN about the lunch yesterday. Here's Van Hollen first, and then you'll hear CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
It was a good meal, and it was a very good conversation.
How long did it last?
I lasted, I believe, over an hour. Went a little bit over time, but it was a very constructive exchange. And look, the president's trying to open every avenue of conversation and dialogue to try and get something done.
Is that how you see it, Jack Beatty?
Well, Paul Ryan is now drawing up a budget that would balance the budget in 10 years. And, of course, in doing that, he's relying on what? The $700 billion that he and Mitt Romney attacked President Obama for cutting out of Medicare. He's pocketing that. That's helping him get to his number, and he's pocketing the, $500 billion in tax increases in January that the president had, which were going to bring the heavens and earth down. So he's got something to be grateful for, because his numbers couldn't even begin to work absent those moves by the president. You know, on this dinner business and this charm offensive, I thought it was emblematic that at the dinner at the Jefferson Hotel, the White House said the president got the tab out of his own pocket, and Senator John Heaven of this Republican of South Dakota said, no, we split the tab, so they couldn't even agree on who was paying for it. I think that may be emblematic. And, you know, Lindsey Graham said the big deal is still there. That would be something. But, you know, Democrats haven't really concentrated on what the big deal involves. And it involves, for the president, considerable concessions on Social Security and Medicare. And, you know, this at the president wanting to go to, you know, chain CPI on Social Security that would effectively lower Social Security benefits. And this at a time when a poll shows that 71% of Republicans, 97% of Democrats want Social Security taxes for the better off to increase. That's their answer to Social Security. That isn't even on the president's menu here.
Susan Davis, what do you think about Republicans willing to compromise on taxes, Democrats willing to compromise on entitlements? I mean, and how do you see Americans' perception of this whole thing unfolding?
I don't see much room in terms of compromise right now. I think Republicans, since the fiscal cliff deal earlier this year that Jack referenced, that raised revenue by raising rates on wealthy Americans, they have drawn a line in the sand. And they have said, we are not raising any more taxes and no more revenues are going to be given to this president. So when you take that firm of position, and it's, as far as I know, unanimous, very few Republicans have said otherwise, barring a couple that have said, I'm willing to raise revenue if the president's willing to fundamentally overhaul entitlement reform. reforms. Things like Democrats are resistant to it, but the idea, the fact that the president has been willing to say things like a small increase in the Medicare age or using chain CPI, which would change the way we calculate Social Security benefits, but it's a relatively minor effect on individual recipients of benefits. The fact that he's willing to do this is hugely significant because in these negotiations, the president has a very unique position, right? He can be, to Republicans, he can be sort of a compromiser and a deal maker. And as the president of the party, he has the ability to maybe drag some of his Democrats over the line to get this deal done. He's really the only person in the Democratic Party right now who can do it. Whether or not he has the ability to do it, I think, is very much in doubt. I do think if you look at the public polling, so in a lot of these debates and confrontations, the public has been on the side of the president. And, you know, he did win re-election, as Democrats like to say. But I would also say as a counter to that, that the public in general just doesn't like Congress. So they're always going to give the president probably a more of advantage when you ask a generic question over who do you think is doing a better job, the president or Congress. I mean, there's very few things that are more unpopular than Congress right now. So he has a public sort of optical advantage, but in terms of being able to translate that into something, I think has so far eluded him.
And yet the president's poll number's down 5 or 6 points, I think it was, since the sequester this week, Susan.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that people associate, and this is why I think part of this charm offensive is coming on now, as much as he tried to put it on Republicans, I think at the end of the day, the American people still see the president as more in charge of the overall national economy.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a week in the news. I'm joined this hour by Susan Davis of USA Today, Gideon Rose of Foreign Affairs Magazine, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Let's go to the first week, our first week post-sequester. Here's some sound from a Thursday press briefing where Speaker of the House John Boehner said that ending the sequester was directly tied to a bipartisan balanced budget deal.
As I made clear many times, that sequestration will remain in effect until cuts and reforms are put in place to put us on a path to balance the budget over the next 10 years.
And on Monday, during a Jersey City press conference, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie attacked President Obama for failing to spearhead a push for results in the sequester showdown.
Real leadership would get this fixed. Get everybody in the room and you fix it. And you don't let them leave until you fix it. That's what real leadership is, not calling a meeting 2 hours before the thing's going to hit to have a photo op in the driveway at the White House. That's not real leadership.
Jack Beatty, is this a fair charge that the president lacks leadership on this thing?
I think the polling reflects that the public thinks that the president ought to have got a deal. A week ago, he was asked at a press conference just what Chris Christie said. Why didn't you lock them in the room and get them to agree? And he said, look, I'm a president. I'm not a dictator. And that makes the point. You know, there's a mystique of the presidency, this idea that somehow there's this leadership dust that he just throws out there. What does he say? A Jedi mind meld, and the opposition will just cave. I mean, this is sentimentality, as the political scientist quoted in the New York Times today, say it really. All of this leadership stuff means nothing unless you've got the votes. He doesn't have the votes, and the reason he doesn't have it is Republicans want to survive primary challenges. They're not going to risk primaries just to, you know, accommodate themselves to his presidential mystique.
Gideon Rose, how do you see this leadership piece?
Well, you know, I think what we were just talking before about how Congress has incredibly low approval ratings, and this is a perfect example of why. I mean, the sequester was a dumb policy. It was supposed to be so dumb that nobody would ever enact it. And when it came time to actually find some alternative at each step along the way, Congress punted, and they essentially embraced, thanks primarily to the House Republicans, a policy that has absolutely zero policy significance. It even cuts the wrong things, discretionary spending and investment, rather than the long-term cuts that everybody agrees are necessary in entitlement programs. And as we just heard, the president has fairly little leverage over House Republicans who are living in essentially strongly Republican districts and who face primary challengers even further to the right. So I think this is a perfect example of not just why the president has some mystique, but why Congress has, frankly, an even higher rating than it deserves in terms of actually being a serious deliberative body for governing the country.
Let's get a listener in on this particular issue. Joe in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Hi, Joe. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Hi.
I just was listening to the gentleman just commented, and he just, you know, kind of sneaked in this little statement that everyone agrees long-term entitlements have to be cut. No, they don't agree with that. I mean, that's absurd, especially for any short-term deficit problems. You know, we go from swapping to talking between the deficit and the debt. You know, the history of modern capitalism is fairly short. Goes back, you know, let's just say 1790. There is no point at which the Republican concepts have ever worked. Not in history. I mean, we're in fact better off doing nothing than we are negotiating with them to do things that are terribly bad for the American workers and the American and global economy.
All right, Joe. Thank you. Actually, Gideon, I'll let you respond to that.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that most observers feel that cuts right now during when you're still having a fairly shaky recovery don't make sense, that austerity policies during a time of recession don't work, but that if you project things out, particularly over a longer term, particularly well past the 10-year mark, if you look at the trends in major U.S. entitlement programs, particularly things like health care, they're simply unsustainable. And so most observers, wonk types looking at these problems, think that the answer should be some kind of reform and investment now and long-term challenges to control healthcare spending in particular, so that tens of decades out, you're not entirely eaten up by entitlement costs.
Susan Davis, Joe's call suggests still great disagreement out there on what cuts are appropriate and when.
Well, and he does get to sort of the reason why this grand bargain has been so elusive is there is this fundamental disagreement over what the number one priority is right now. And for Republicans, that number one priority is paying down the debt and balancing the budget. Paul Ryan is going to put out a budget next week that balances the budget in 10 years. We have a $16.4 trillion deficit. It's growing and with no turnaround in sight. And in some ways, that's sort of the austerity argument. Now, Democrats would argue, and they may not say this in exactly these words, but they don't find the deficit as great a threat as Republicans do. And Bill Clinton has spoken to this recently as well and saying the problem right now is not the deficit. The problem is that we don't have the economic growth to sustain the cuts that they want to make. That we until the job rate, until we have lower unemployment, until we have higher economic growth, you can't really start to look at cutting until we start to be growing stronger. So Democrats are very resistant to these kind of cuts because they think it's only going to hamper the economy longer term. Also on entitlements, this is probably the greatest fundamental divide between the two parties. Democrats are willing and maybe open to some trims and some tweaks. Maybe you make wealthier people pay more for Medicare and Social Security benefits. But the fundamental systems they want to protect and ensure, whereas Republicans have rallied around a proposal by Paul Ryan that would fundamentally change the way seniors get their Medicare benefits in this country. And that would be through what they would call a premium support program, which is when you would give seniors a federal subsidy to buy insurance on their own. I mean, that is a radical rewrite of the social safety net. And it's hard to see where the two of them are going to find a middle ground there.
Susan, you mentioned unemployment and how that plays into this economic recovery. We've got some new jobs numbers out today. U.S. employers are ramping up their hiring in February, adding 236,000 jobs, pushing the unemployment rate down to its lowest rate in 4 years, 7.7%, down from 7.9% in January. Jack Beatty, I'll turn to you. Most encouraging news today? What do you see in these numbers?
Well, indeed, they are extremely encouraging, and it follows a week of, you could say, exuberant economic news. The stock market at all-time high, and then we had on Monday the New York Times report about the profitability of American corporations way up, their share of national income way up. Great time to be a stockholder of a big corporation, but bad time to be a worker. I mean, the return, the share of national income going to labor as opposed to profit hasn't been as bad as this, as low as this in 40 or 50 years. And, you know, here's a dilemma for the president. He can't do anything for to close the inequality gap legislatively, probably, maybe the minimum wage. But he could do some things, perhaps administratively or at least legislatively, without causing Americans to pay more taxes, without running into that that barricade on taxes. And one would be to close the gender wage gap. A study for the American Association of University Women found that if you were to close that gap, which amounts over a woman's career to $1.2 million less than a man with the same training, same education, $1.2 million over her career, if you did that, you would add nearly 2 points to the GDP right there, and that would come all out of the hide of these big corporations. The president should start talking about things like that.
Jack, let me go back to your comments about the stock market, because I wanted to get this sound in from last Thursday's briefing when House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said she was encouraged by the rising stock market. She expressed concern that average Americans, however, are not seeing the same economic progress.
This week, we saw something quite remarkable, the stock market soaring to new heights. Same time, we see productivity keeping pace with all of that, reaching great heights. But we don't see income for America's middle class rising.
Gideon Rose, how do you see these new economic numbers?
Well, the economic numbers are good. Let's remind ourselves that the supposed stock market highs are not, in fact, actual highs. They're just nominal ones. We're still below the peak where we actually were in real dollar terms over broad market measures in the past. But that said, there has been progress in the stock market, and there is sign that money is coming off the sidelines. I think one of the reasons is because people can't get yields from things like bonds anymore, and so they're going to companies with dividends and putting their money in the market. But the real issue, again, is even if you have the market come back, and even, frankly, if you can get growth coming back, how can you get a society and an economy that rewards all sectors and all participants, not just those lucky enough to have very good jobs or investable income? And the challenge there is we need to get infrastructure going back in good shape. We need to get education going. We need to invest in our population and keep our social welfare programs in good order, funded, but not so that they cripple the entire economy. And again, most people, I think, would feel that the answer is some kind of non-austerity program now, where you don't burden the recovery with extra weight, having to make it carry an extra load. But then over time, you increase business and economic certainty that the economy will be able to grow well because it doesn't have a terrible fiscal burden looming down the road.
Susan Davis, is there a disconnect between these market highs and the true state of the U.S. economy?
I definitely think there's a disconnect between market highs and sort of everyday American life, and we see that through any number of measures. I also think part of the things that we've seen is that one of the cultural effects of the economic crisis is that we have shifted from a society that tends to spend more to one that has been saving more. Americans are keeping more money inside their own bank accounts. They're not spending it. They're not putting it into the economy. And I think that's part of the reverberation of fears and lessons of what happened. I also think when you look at the policies that Washington is doing, the sequester being a perfect example of that. If you are a federal worker or in a household with a federal worker or work for a defense contractor and are now facing furloughs, there's a question of whether there's going to be this secondary economic effect, right? You know, not only are you potentially facing a furlough, but does a family then decide, well, let's wait and not buy that car because we don't know what our income's going to be this year because the government keeps screwing up. So I think the government's failure in this is feeding that uncertainty that has had this sort of secondary effect that's been hampering economic growth as well.
Jack, your last thoughts on this?
Well, Paul Krugman today has a sort of I told you so column. He writes those fairly regularly, frankly, pointing out that, that the kinds of predictions made about President Obama and this economy have made by people like the Wall Street Journal have just simply not happened. I mean, they predicted what? There'd be the bond vigilantes would strike, bond government yields on bonds are down to half of what they were when the president was elected. The stock market is way up. It sounds as if this socialist is very good for capitalism just by the numbers.
Hmm. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. This week, one story that got a lot of attention was when Kentucky Senator Rand Paul staged the longest filibuster in recent Senate memory. He talked on the floor for more than 12 hours against drone strikes and the CIA nominee John Brennan. Here's a little sound from that.
I rise today to begin to filibuster John Brennan's nomination for the CIA. I will speak until I can no longer speak. I will speak as long as it takes until the alarm is sounded from coast to coast that our Constitution is important.
Gideon Rose, John Brennan was confirmed. Ultimately, what did Rand Paul accomplish?
Well, he gave everybody a good news story, and I think he actually made a good contribution to discussing what an actual filibuster should be, because he put his mouth where his policy was rather than just simply doing a procedural motion and put a hold on things and screwing up government without paying any price himself. So I think that's a good signal for others. In terms of the actual drone program, I mean, I think this is a somewhat typical case of Congress focusing on issues that are sort of parallel to the real ones. I actually see the problems in the drone program less about the possibility that we'll use executive power to kill American citizens or particularly kill American citizens here at home via drones. That's not my worry that black helicopters will be replaced by black drones over the Midwest or whatever, but rather that when the technology allowing drones to operate proliferates ever more abroad, we're going to be in a situation in which the policies we have been using so long as we've had a monopoly will no longer be sustainable. In other words, we're not going to let other countries do to U.S. citizens what we have been doing to their citizens, killing with impunity on a basically a statistical pattern of behavior and so forth. And so the real question I have is, shouldn't we be thinking now about what a sustainable regime for drone strikes would be internationally that will follow the period of U.S. monopoly in this technology? So it's not so much about, in my opinion, about what the U.S. government is doing vis-a-vis its own citizens. It's how we can make drone strikes a legitimate, sustainable tool of American foreign and security policy over the long term rather than just something we do until everybody else gets the same technology.
Let me get a couple of callers in on this point before our break. Nick is in Hamden, Connecticut. Hi, Nick. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I did want to speak about, I'm glad we started talking about the American worker, because essentially all Paul did was he put in a shift and a half as a Walmart employee, a greeter. Standing up and talking for a shift and a half isn't something I think that should be universally applauded, but just this is what Americans do every day, real working Americans. And again, the point about the drone strikes, I believe it's just misdirection.
All right. Oh, Nick, thank you. Okay. Jay is on the line now from Shelton, Connecticut. Nick, I'm glad you called. Sorry for that. Jay, go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Like I said to your screener, I just think that was a carefully contrived political farce. He gave the appearance of genuine concern because he did the filibuster the way it's supposed to be done. But really, you can't demand promises of any administration that you're not going to use drones on American citizens or otherwise. You don't know what could happen. And you can't give a promise like that. You can't make that commitment. And you don't know what could happen, domestic or otherwise.
Jay, thank you. Thank you very much. Jack Beatty, jump in here. Eric Holder, response to all this? Tell us what that was.
Well, he essentially said to Rand Paul, no, we are not going to use drones to kill American citizens in the United States. Of course, people could say they have many more efficient means of doing that. And that does raise a question that Mr. Holder really got wrong. In a colloquy with Lindsey Graham, he said that the war on terror, the authority Congress voted right after 9/11, that authority gives the president the power to have Americans killed here. And it does not. Congress ruled that out right from the start. The Attorney General, who's advising the president about legality, had that wrong.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the news this week. Here are some other headlines. A Mississippi baby infected with HIV was declared functionally cured. Dr. Hannah Gay, the HIV specialist treating the child, said she could not believe the initial results.
I really assumed that it was due to lab error, so I called her back in, and we redid that viral load and also did some other testing. And I was exceptionally surprised when all of those tests came back negative.
Incredible story. A disturbing 911 call in Bakersfield, California, after 87-year-old Lorraine Bayless collapsed on the floor at her independent living facility. The resident director there refused to perform CPR or pass the phone along to someone else because it was not protocol for the facility. Bayless later died. Here is the 911 dispatcher.
Anybody there can do CPR. Give them the phone, please. I understand if your facility is not willing to do that, give the phone to that passerby, that stranger that had the vent. This woman's not breathing enough. She's going to die if we don't get this started.
And the TSA will now allow small knives on airplanes. On NBC's Today Show, Association of Flight Attendants Vice President Sarah Nelson said, as a flight attendant herself, she is not happy.
The flight attendants are in the back as the last line of defense defending that aircraft, and we need the support to make sure that our cabin, our workspace, and the travel space for millions of passengers is safe as well.
I'm joined this hour by Susan Davis of USA Today, Gideon Rose of Foreign Affairs Magazine, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. I want to talk now about North Korea. On Thursday, the United Nations Security Council passed tougher sanctions against North Korea, targeting the secretive nuclear program there hours after Pyongyang threatened a possible preemptive nuclear attack. Here's Susan Rice speaking after the vote.
The entire world stands united in our commitment to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and in our demand that North Korea comply with its international obligations. If it does not, then the Security Council committed today in this resolution to take further significant measures.
Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine, these sanctions, as you know, are among the most comprehensive in a long time. What real impact will they have?
You know, I know I should care more about this, but I really find it hard to because it really is Groundhog Day in North Korea. They do something obstreperous. We respond with further sanctions and a further condemnation. They pledge to do even more bad things. And the cycle sort of heats up tensions for a while, and then it goes back to the dormant state that it's been in for almost six decades now. The fact is the sanctions are going to hurt in some respects, but we give them enough of a lifeline on things like humanitarian aid to prevent complete and total famine and human chaos that the regime can live. If North Korea actually cared about economic development or progress, it would have changed its behavior many, many years ago. They don't really. So I just see this as kind of like an act that we all have to go through. It's got really high stakes, so it is important. So I'm being overly flippant, I think. But there really is a Groundhog Day aspect to this, and I don't think this is going to go anywhere particularly significant on either side.
Well, since you take that tone, I will throw in this sound from Dennis Rodman this week, okay? Here he is, the former basketball player appearing on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. He defended his recent trip to North Korea and his meeting with leader Kim Jong-un.
He's a great guy. He's just a great guy. If you sit down and talk to him, you know, perception is perceiving how things work.
A great
work.
Guy who puts 200,000 people in prison camps?
Well, you know, and guess what? It's amazing how we do the same thing here.
We have prison camps here in the
United
States?
We don't have prison camps. Guess what? This is all politics, right? This is all politics, right? And the one thing, he don't want to do that.
It did get a lot of play, Gideon Rose. What do you make of this unusual trip to North Korea?
You know, maybe we're going to get past sort of South Park and Team America jokes to Dennis Rodman jokes on North Korea. Instead of, you know, I hate you, Hans Blix, we'll get the Dennis Rodman quotes. That's just ridiculous, and it's an embarrassment. But, you know, seriously, are we talking Dennis Rodman's views on North Korea as something we should be discussing here?
Susan Davis, no real danger in North Korea. Do you take them seriously when they threaten a nuclear attack?
I sort of have to agree with everything that Gideon said. It's hard. It's with so much of this, it seems like it's just the latest iteration of hostile activity from them. I do think it's curious, and one of the things that I've just been looking to see, and it's a little too early to have anything definitive to say about it, but it is interesting to see how new Secretary of State John Kerry is sort of seeking to tackle these issues and break out from in his era as Secretary of State in the post-Hillary Clinton era. And he's had no shortage of activities, Dennis Rodman being the least one of those.
Yes, Jack, was that you jumping in there?
No, but I will jump
in. Okay.
You know, it says in the Times today that the Obama administration is debating the wisdom of its having, quote, ignored North Korea for the last 4 years. Wait a minute. Ignored North Korea? I mean, that's a fuse that's been going throughout all of our lifetimes. And the North Koreans say, now, of course, you can't posit irrationality, perhaps, but they say they are building these weapons to deter an attack by the United States. And they have said through the years, we want direct talks with the United States to have a peace treaty on the, you know, to actually end the Korean War and to recognize the legitimacy of our regime. Now, I know there have been all kinds of problems doing that, but surely the president who's going to leave office, you know, and if he doesn't have to face the electorate again, they can't call him weak. Shouldn't he try to lower the tension on that peninsula by perhaps saying to the North, all right, we can't go on with this. Let's talk about a peace treaty. Let's talk about what would give you the sort of moral equivalent of deterrence, namely a guarantee of your regime.
Let's turn. Gideon.
I think the answer to that one is that it's sort of like Lucy in the football. Every time we try and do something along those lines, they end up pocketing concessions and not giving up. I don't think anybody thinks they're going to actually give up their nuclear capability, just like everyone saw what happened when Gaddafi gave up his nuclear capability. It was bye-bye Gaddafi a few years later. So I think that, you know, what nuclear weapons get North Korea is indeed a get-out-of-jail-free from regime change. But the rest of us have to deal with it. The most interesting North Korea question for me is, why don't more people see it as a potential parallel to Iran? In other words, we were told that North Korea getting nukes would be the end of the world, the start of a giant major conflagration, and instead it's just meant that we can indeed ignore North Korea for a decade now. The interesting implication there is if Iran gets nukes, it may not be the end of the world either, and it may be something that, you know, we can sort of have to deal with on a temporary basis perennially, but not necessarily fundamentally change everything across the Middle East.
Susan Davis, would you jump in?
I mean, I think that the security – part of the thing that I think is interesting is that the U.S. has just had far fewer security interests in that area. And if anything, the security interests have been more of the economic variety in Asia and wanting to maintain good relationships around there. The dynamic – the parallel to Iran, which I think is totally right in terms of security, but our interests in the region seem so vastly different in terms of why we're there and why how we negotiate with them.
Wesley is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee on this point. Wesley, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment that the Kim Jong Un can't be so uninformed on this subject that they would keep this up. You know, knowing that they're not knowing what they look like, it's almost like they have this masochistic cycle of self-deprecation. That knowing that these sanctions are going to be imposed, they don't care about the effect that it's going to have on their people, and they don't care about their international reputation enough that, if they did gain the technology to mount a nuclear attack, knowing that it's suicide, I don't think that they would care because of the nature of their lack of caring about their reputation and the effect on them, the negative effect on them in the past.
Which makes you think that if they did get nuclear capability, they might actually use it. I appreciate your call, Wesley. Thank you very much. The clock is ticking, and I want to move from North Korea to Venezuela because this week, of course, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez died at the age of 58. There's a state funeral for him today. Here's some sound from Vice President Nicolas Maduro announcing yesterday that Chavez's body will be on display in perpetuity. Here he is, interpreted by Al Jazeera English.
It's been decided to prepare the body of the commander president, embalm it so it can be left to be seen eternally, so the people can have him there in his Museum of the Revolution.
Like Ho Chi Minh, Gideon Rose, like Lenin, I mean, I can't let him go, I guess, over there in Venezuela.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've never quite understood why we've paid, why the United States has been so thin-skinned and paid so much attention to Chavez over the years, in the sense that, I mean, here was a guy who basically had a country with a lot of oil and who had somewhat silly and outdated political views about the socialist economic revolution in Latin America that was really a generation or two out of date. He was able to fund that and do some poverty programs at home thanks to the oil revenues he was getting. But during his tenure, Venezuela had a low rate of economic growth. It had high inflation, chronic shortages of goods. It has lots of crime. And essentially, his revolution failed, and it didn't have impact across the region where market reforms have actually and democratic reforms have taken off in other countries from Mexico to Brazil and beyond. And so I think that, you know, you don't want to make, you know, say nasty things about the dead, but his passing isn't going to be mourned. And we really should never have given him as much attention as a major threat or opponent as we did. And now, essentially, Venezuela is going to be left confronting the legacy of yet another attempt at sort of failed socialist economic policy.
So, Jack Beatty, is it in U.S. interest to improve relations with Venezuela, to your mind?
I think it is, and I think the interesting aspect of this is its connection to Cuba. I mean, as everyone has pointed out, the special period in Cuba following the collapse of the Soviet Union was catastrophic for the Cuban economy. The Havana Zoo, the peacocks disappeared, the buffalo disappeared, Cuban domestic cats disappeared from the streets. It was just a horror. I mean, malnutrition, calorie counts way down, terrible time for them, and Hugo Chavez saved them with this oil bonanza he shared with them, and they were able to sell actually on the world market about nearly half of the oil that he gave them at low prices. If that were to stop, Cuba is right back in this special period crisis. And a friend of mine, Bill Craig, who's written a wonderful book, Yankee Come Home, about Cuba, tells me that people down there say we won't go through another special period. That won't happen here. There will be trouble here because we can't go back to, you know, eating the peacocks from the zoo.
I want to shift gears a bit here now. Here's some sound from former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and her husband, former NASA astronaut Mark Kelly. They spoke at a gun control rally on Wednesday in Tucson, Arizona. It was held at the supermarket where Giffords was shot in the head during a political event. Giffords and Kelly recently started a gun control advocacy group, not to get rid of guns, they say, but to have more sensible laws, including stronger background checks.
Be bold, be courageous, please support background checks. Thank you very much.
Susan Davis, it looks like there is a movement in the Senate on some gun control bills. Where do we stand today?
I think, if anything, there is the most movement behind the background check component of it. It has been hung up right now in committee, but they are debating it. I mean, this is actually something that's underway. I think one of the things is it's easy to say we should have tighter background checks, but once you get into the details, the policy gets very complicated. For example, one of the issues that they are discussing right now in Congress is whether or not background checks between private gun owners should have to be registered with the government. For instance, if a neighbor decides to sell a gun to his neighbor, would that require what paperwork and registration requirements would that require on top of it? And it sounds like small details, but these things matter. But the committees are moving forward. Harry Reid, the majority leader of the Senate, has committed action to it with an open process on the floor. So we are going to have gun action on a gun bill or gun safety bill or whatever it may be coming out of the Senate this year, probably later in the spring. But I still said, and I've said it all along, and I have seen nothing to change the thought on this, that the idea that we are going to renew the assault weapons ban or dramatically change the type of ammunition that people can purchase still faces an incredibly difficult uphill prospect in Congress. And I would say it's almost entirely unlikely that particularly the assault weapons ban has a chance of passage.
Gideon Rose, do you agree?
I think so, unfortunately. But I think, on the other hand, any kind of progress on this front is more than we expected just a few months ago. So it would be welcome.
I want to get in the Catholic Church looking for its new pope here. Here's some sound from Sunday morning's Face the Nation. Catholic Archbishop of New York, Timothy Dolan, talked about the child sex abuse scandal that the Catholic Church has been facing and if this issue will be something the cardinals will discuss during the pre-conclave meetings. Here he is.
There's no cardinal with his head in the sand when it comes to these issues. The church, of course, while it is not of the world, it does exist in the world. So it shouldn't surprise us that the afflictions of the world, and you've just named some of them, sexual immorality, perversion, abuse of children, that affects all elements of society and culture, are particularly hideous when it comes to the church. And that will be an issue, I predict it will.
Gideon Rose, how do you see these pre-conclave meetings? How do you view them?
Well, you know, it's fascinating. The Catholic Church, of course, is this extraordinary worldwide institution which has a hierarchy unlike some of the other major religions. And so everybody pays attention to who the head of the Catholic Church is. Of course, there isn't a head of Judaism or a head of Islam or a head of Protestantism overall. And it's fascinating. We're all watching this play out. I think the internal institutional dynamics are things that non-Catholics don't necessarily know much about or are able to comment on. But we're all watching this incredible pageant in its historic setting with bated breath.
Susan, you as well?
You know, one of the things I think is going to be interesting, and there isn't much that we know about the conclave and how the Pope is selected, to think that there's going to be much of a revolution in thought in the Catholic Church. But the Catholic Church has, and I was born and raised Catholic, and the Catholic Church has facing a tremendous existential crisis going forward in the world. When you look at the dwindling numbers of people who identify as Catholic, particularly in the United States, a growing willingness among people to do things like let priests marry or change views on contraception that I think have made many people feel alienated from the Church in the modern world. It'll be very curious to see who they pick, whether they will break from the mold of European popes and what they would say. And they have the potential to send a very powerful message to the world. It's just unclear if they're ready or willing to do that.
Well, we will be watching. I appreciate the panel today. It was a terrific conversation. Susan Davis, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Thanks for your time, Susan.
Thank you.
Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine. I appreciate your time, Gideon. Thanks.
Good to be here.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Jack, thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.